click kaya959.co.za
to download the Kaya Biz podcast.
We're going to build up our conversation now by taking a look at the trade tariffs conversations. Clarity came out yesterday from the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition around South Africa's positioning. And the truth is, not much has changed. We're keeping to the 30%. We've had little to no room to renegotiate with the US, despite the fact that the DTIC statement did highlight that they've worked robustly with industry and insights, leaders and counterparts to make sure that they evaluate all the respective outcomes that could come around from the increase in tariffs. As we know, certain sectors of our economy are going to be greatly impacted, some more than others. And tonight we're going to get some insight into how the agricultural space in particular will feel the pinch. To help us unpack the agricultural sector's response and maybe positioning in order to unlock a lot more vast potential, especially in light of the latest insight we've had from the DTIC, we're joined by Abri Rotenbach, Managing Executive for Sector Head Agriculture at APSA CIB. Abri, such a pleasure to have you and welcome to the show, sir.
Good evening, Gugu. Yeah, thank you for having me and good evening to the listeners.
I can imagine that the last few weeks, maybe even months, you haven't slept quite a bit because together with your team and when you speak to your clients within the agricultural space, there's been a great level of anxiety around the tariffs and the reciprocal tariffs that the US is actually placing on South Africa. Given yesterday's announcement, what's your response to our positioning?
Yeah, Gugu. So, I mean, it is really around food security, and it's a term that's now, featuring quite often when we engage with different countries. You know, if you ask them from importance, you know, it's most probably one of the three top priorities. It will definitely have an effect on us. South Africa is a net exporter of commodities, which just means that we produce more than what we can consume and we export. And it's extremely important for South Africa to earn that foreign currency. And in scope is something like citrus, which we export to the US. And I must say, you know, in the past it was under the AGOA agreement. But I think since the first tariff has been leveraged, that agreement is actually not in place. It exists on paper. But at the moment, we're in the middle of our citrus season. Our clients in the Western Cape export, to the US at the moment. It's at 10%. It used to be duty-free. The other areas, the other producers of citrus cannot export to the US due to certain diseases. So it's really the Western Cape that's in play here. It's around about 5% of the national crop that gets exported to the US. Okay. But once again, for a producer in the Western Cape, it's much more than that. So it is fairly important. I think the other important fact is that we are not competing with the US. They're in the Northern Hemisphere, we're in the Southern Hemisphere. Mm. So when we have produce, they don't have produce. So it's really not competing with them. There's some of the other commodities also at play. We see there's some wine, there's some nuts, raisins, and then juices that we export to the US. I think the other thing, if I can just quickly pause at the wine.
Yes.
What is extremely important and what we've seen with COVID when we were not allowed for that first period to export alcohol was that we lost shelf space. It's very difficult to get back onto the shelf once you've lost it. So, yes, any tariff, it's not good for us, and when we engage with different industries and some think tanks, we also can't go to the table without giving something. So, it's to be a win-win for both parties. One of the difficult things that we anticipate that would be on the US agenda to export into South Africa would be chickens, poultry, and pork. We've got a very delicate local industry. And as you know, it's so important to protect some of our jobs in South Africa at the moment.
Wow.
It's really the livelihood. So I think it's not an easy discussion, to give and to ask. I'm glad I'm not the person that needs to have that negotiations.
I can imagine, Abri, and thank you so much for, you know, such a wonderful breakdown for us to understand the various consequences that exist. Just to keep with this topic for a little longer, what I am keen to understand is many have been saying, well, surely some of our agricultural producers can just pass on the cost to the U.S. consumers. But help us understand why that might not be an option. And given that this does influence their margins, how this could influence and have a negative consequence on the business and revenue aspects of the agricultural producers that we're talking about here.
Yeah, thank you, Gugu. And I think a good question. And you know, as APSA CIB, you know, it is some of the questions that we're consistently checking with clients. So I think at the 10% level, you know, that's the point where the value chain actually can absorb quite a bit of the, a tariff. So as an example, you know, your importers can carry a bit, your producer can sacrifice a bit, and your consumer can pay a bit more. But I think when you get to 30%, then you start competing with Peru and Chile. That's a lot closer to the U.S.
Yeah.
You know, and once again, specifically talking to citrus, because we're right in the middle of our season. And you know, they negotiate for 10% tariff. So immediately you're on the back foot, your product is more expensive. And the question is whether that consumer would pay more for that. And then I think once again, if you look at inflation, you know, right internationally, I think all consumers in the majority of parts in the world is under pressure. So it's really doubtful whether a consumer would be able to absorb 30% or then the value chain. What we do hope, you know, if we, as a last resort, is if Chile and Peru would take up some of that citrus space, you know, that they would pull out of other markets. So then you just, it's important that you then find that gap in that market to be able, you know, to move it to that where the gap arise, because I think it's once again important that production is not increasing. This is just a movement of produce and a disruption of trade patterns at the moment. It is quite important that you have a clear view around what is happening internationally in all the markets, you know, so that you are able to quickly adjust. And once again, it's a perishable product, so you can't keep it for long. You need to move it. You need to be quite flexible to move it.
And coupled with it being a perishable product, it's also food, right? So there's sensitivities to it. And maybe this is also another complexity that you can elaborate on, Abri. I recall a time where there were black spots on some of our citrus and it was actually banned or halted from being exported to markets like the EU, or it might have been Middle East. I can't recall. But that was quite a sensitive issue. Do we find that different nations, regions and countries have different regulations around the appearance, basically the health and safety of the particular product, especially given that we're talking about citrus, fresh produce here?
Yeah, Gugu, yeah, and you actually know it quite a lot. So, you know, it's definitely, I think one needs to understand that there's tariffs and then there's non-tariff barriers. So quite often it is around the science behind, you know, whatever is the issue, and understanding that. So the Western Cape, once again, you know, they are the guys that can export to the US specifically due to black spot and false Godlington moth. And that's exactly some of the disputes that we're currently having with the EU. And for the first time, you know, we've actually lodged a case at the World Trade Organization. It's the first time in our history, and it's specifically around our citrus being exported into the EU, where they say we need to cool down, they call it a steady process, and we need to cool down our citrus to 2 degrees for an extended period of time in excess of 20 days.
Sure.
Now, once again, at 2 degrees, it's very close to freezing point. And these fruit can't, you know, withstand for a long period of time. So it reduces the shelf life, you know, quite dramatically if you do it at 2 degrees. If I remember correctly, it's 22 days that you need to keep it at that temperature. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of shelf life. So we see that as South Africa, we see that specifically as a non-tariff barrier that's being used, you know, to keep our citrus so that we don't compete with Spain. Specifically on citrus with Spain. So our late season, you know, reaches into their early season, and that's where we compete. So they try to keep us out. But I think if you just think back, you know, 4 years and COVID, you know, diseases is an extremely important part of the landscape. Whether it's animal disease or diseases on fruit or vegetables or food, so it's very high on priority lists. And it takes extremely long to negotiate these protocols. Mm. So if we would like to open a market where we don't have access to, you know, it can nearly take 2 years to establish those protocols. Before you can start exporting. Mm. So it's not a quick game to open a new market. It's extremely important. And once again, you know, I feel quite strong that South African produce is of such a high quality. If you've ever traveled and you've tasted fruit in other parts of the world, you know, ours are very tasty. So it's really a product of quality and therefore should, you know, demand a premium rather than competing with everything else. So a lot to be proud of as well.
Mm. I'm so glad you mentioned that, Abri. I recall tasting grapes in the US and I was like, I'm not too sure. We probably have a better crop back here at home. And you're right, there's been so many developments that impact the industry, and it's not just tariffs, but there's also other barriers to markets. And despite that, Abri, I'm so taken by this conversation, but I'm aware that there's another theme and concept we can also discuss, being the potential that exists on the continent's agricultural landscape. There are many research studies that talk about Africa having at least 70% of the world's most arable land, but we haven't been using it adequately. And there's some examples that we can draw across from the continent to reposition ourselves, just to make sure that not only do we produce great quality produce, but also opportunities to expand when it comes to trade, maybe within the continent itself. Do you have some research and insight into this? Talk us through some of these themes.
Yeah, Gugu. So I think, you know, South Africa and Africa, and as broader as the continent, plays an extremely important role in terms of food security. Because once again, if you just plot population growth, and you plot food production, you know, there's a point where what we've got can't maintain, you know, the growth that's coming in. And therefore, you know, Africa with all this, unutilized resources being land, and I mean our sunshine and water that we've got, is extremely important and should be extremely important for the whole, international landscape. And once again, if we look in South Africa, we've got a lot of commercial farming. Once you go outside of South Africa, you know, it's a lot small scale. And we see that for a number of reasons why it's not ticking up at the moment. Just before I go into the reasons, if you plot, the only thing that kept us in the game is the technology. And that technology could be from precision farming to irrigation to biotechnology, which could be seeds and the development of seeds. But apart from that, there's an underinvestment of infrastructure, you know, on the continent. And we start to see it even in South Africa with our ports and our road systems. Once you're out of the big metros, you know, the quality of the roads are not great. And remember that roads need to transport inputs in, and it needs to transport produce out. Then we also see, you know, there's a low productivity. And what we mean with that is that on the continent, you know, that the answer was always, you know, plant more hectares instead of focusing on increasing the yield on that, on 1 hectare. And we can see other development countries, you know, like Brazil, putting a lot of effort and having huge successes around that. And then policy and market failures, you know, it's very difficult, you know, these government policies. So it needs to support investment and create, you know, a regulatory environment. Then we also, where APSA plays a big role, it's, you know, access to finance. You know, these smallholder farmers, you know, they find it very difficult, you know, to, and that's where something like Actec or platforms, you know, can play a great role. And then we see, you know, very strong value chains, but we also see inadequate value chains where some of the processing we produce and then we export for further processing and we import back in. So there's a great opportunity there. You've also spoken about Africa and trade. Is the Africa Free Trade Agreement that's currently being worked on. I wish we could fast forward that a little bit. It would have helped in... But also, if you've traveled by road, you would understand, you know, once again, a perishable product, you can't stand for too long at a border post, you know, it needs to be able to get through quite quickly. Exactly. So, yeah, lots of work, but lots of potential as well.
So much potential. And I'm glad that you highlighted some of these risks, because this is often what we take for granted, right, is understanding the supply chain and the controls that will be required to maintain fresh produce at a particular quality and level of delivery. I'm keen to understand, naturally, this means that there does need to be a lot more investment, you know, maybe even private-public partnerships, and entrepreneurs also to be a lot more innovative in how they try to get, you know, the biggest yield from their harvests, and even looking at collaborative approaches as well from a community or entrepreneurial level through cooperatives. Is this something that we do see, you know, growing and developing on the continent?
Definitely. And I think in your intro, you mentioned, you know, Kenya, you know, which have the biggest tea cooperative. It's the biggest exporter of tea out of the continent. You know, it's actually 600,000 small scale farmers that belongs to the cooperative, which is massive, you know, but they're so big that they also can provide some of the microfinance, you know, into that. They help these farmers, you know, get fertilizers. You know, then, I mean, being integrated in a cooperative model, you know, you reduce the overhead cost because you provide a lot of services to these farmers, you know, and like I said, the result was that Kenya is the biggest exporter of tea, you know, and you can see that collaboration includes, you know, government, it includes, you know, commercial large-scale farmers and small-scale growers, which is a great story. Ivory Coast is another one. You know, these cashew nuts, you know, they produce a big percentage of the world's production of cashew, and where they've also been able to collaborate, you know, public and private. You know, they created infrastructure and enabling policies that actually boosted these export. And I think what is great of this example, you know, they were able to create 18,000 jobs, and specifically for females, which is great. You know, we're always concerned about youth and female and their employment. And yeah, the Ivory Coast became one of the largest producers. You know, contributing nearly 40% of the global supply. So it's the lesson here is that you can have a mix of a cooperative structure with a deliberate strategy, enabling investment climate, you know, and go into infrastructure develop, you know, and then expanding these value chains.
Yeah, makes sense, Abri. There's so many lessons here and practical examples that you've alluded to. Abri, you've mentioned Ivory Coast, and because I've been recently reading up on the cocoa prices, maybe this is my application to be your intern, hey? There's a lot happening in agriculture and I'm enjoying this conversation. I'm so keen to hear your thoughts on climate and weather changes and patterns and the impact that this could have on certain products and their yield. And largely, if we can refer to cocoa as an example, because we've witnessed that as a result of weather changes in Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal, that's impacting chocolate producers. And as a result, us as chocolate lovers now need to pay more for this product because of the increase in the cost of securing cocoa as a crop or commodity.
Yeah, Gugu, you're 100% right. And what follows cocoa shortly is my favorite product. It's coffee. So yes. You can also see the price of local coffee in South Africa increasing due to these shifting patterns of weather. It's very difficult to determine, what is a long-term pattern and what is just a normal drought, or a flood. We do have these El Nino and La Nino phenomena, a wet and a dry. We've just come out of a fairly wet summer in South Africa. If you drive around in rural South Africa, you'll see that there's still a lot of maize that's, the guys are struggling to harvest due to the wetness in these lands or the fields. So you need to be, and I guess once again, that's where technology plays a big role. The seed technologies of such a nature, we call it biotechnology, that you can have a shorter grower, so in the past, maize used to need to have 6 months to grow. You can now see it in 4 to 5 months. You can see drought resistant, seeds. So there's a lot of technology that needs to be used, to make sure that we counter, some of these climate issues. Once again, I think if you talk about small scale farmers, it just became so much and more complex than with big commercial clients, because this economy of scale and the surplus ability and capacity to deal some of these bigger themes are difficult. We as APSA are trying and working very hard, to try and get some, crop insurance, which will mitigate some of these, weather events. And we've done, as APSA CIB, quite a bit of work around climate models and where stuff will shift to. Some areas will become better, some will become worse, and some need to some adjustment, between what you plant and when you plant. So it's a very complex topic, especially when you get to the smaller producers. It's something that we monitor. And once again, it's so difficult to split climate with food security, because it's you can do everything green, but you most probably not gonna have the same yield or the same output. So it's really this balancing act of keeping farmers, which provides a massive amount of employment and contribute to Africa GDP. It's nearly 30% of Africa's GDP comes out of agriculture, and nearly 60% of people is employed in this sector, in Africa, if you look at the whole continent. So it's really a difficult exam question to try and balance all these things, and you need to be mindful and you need to use technology that's available. I think, the one point that I would like to leave with you is that, agriculture is nature, so farmers are very sensitive towards, their environment and understand sustainability without it being linked to an ESG or a policy.
Yes.
It's just by nature of survival. They need to take care of their resource, which is the soil and also anything that's in and surrounding that area.
100%. Abri, this has been such a fascinating conversation with you tonight, sir. Really appreciate the insight and the detail you've given us. I'm hoping that next time, next year, when Nampo happens again, the agricultural festival, that I'll be able to experience a lot more of this insight with you and your team, to hear the sensitivities of the agricultural space, but also just so much opportunity that continues to exist. Thank you again, sir. Ons waardeer jou tyd baie.
Thank you, Gugu. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Abri. Abri Rautenbach, Managing Executive for Sector Head of Agriculture at APSA CIB.
Kaya Biz with Gugu Letumfuphi, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 8 p.m. on Kaya 959. Click.
kaya959.co.za
to download the Kaya Biz podcast.